Welcome to Dissenting Opinions, a podcast by the Constitutional Law Institute at the University of Chicago Law School. I'm your host, William Bode, and each episode we'll have top legal minds discuss a Supreme Court case they believe is misunderstood.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
This episode, we're going to talk to Professor Genevieve Lakier about Virginia State Board of Pharmacy versus Virginia Citizens Consumer Council. This is a Supreme Court case decided in 1976, where the court decided that commercial advertising is protected by the Constitution. The court stopped the state of Virginia from enforcing a law that said pharmacists couldn't advertise drug prices. This decision changed the course of free speech doctrine by holding that commercial speech is entitled to constitutional protection.
We'll hear arguments next in 74-895, Virginia's Board of Pharmacy against Consumers Council.
Today I'm here talking with one of my favorite colleagues, Genevieve Lakier, about the First Amendment, about which she luckily has a lot of interesting and different views. Genevieve, as you know, this podcast is about Supreme Court cases most people think are terrible, but that you might think actually have some virtues, or vice versa. So I'm curious, what decision do you have in mind for us to talk about?
The decision I really like that most people don't like is called Virginia State Board of Pharmacy v. Virginia Citizens Consumer Council. For First Amendment and free speech people, it's a really important case because it was decided in 1976. It's one of the Burger Court's like blockbuster First Amendment cases. And it's important because it's the first time that the court explicitly holds directly that purely commercial advertising is protected by the First Amendment.
We hold that these consumers enjoy the same First Amendment protection that advertisers have to disseminate prescription drug price information, and thus that the appellees, as recipients of the information, have standing to bring the suit. We further hold that so-called commercial speech is not wholly outside the protection of the First and 14th Amendments. The individual consumer and society in general may have strong interests in the free flow of commercial information.
By the time we get to this decision, Virginia State Pharmacy Board, there's been a lot of internal disagreement and uncertainty, anxiety in the court about what to do about advertising. And so little by little in the years prior to Virginia State Board, the court had been extending more First Amendment protection to certain kinds of ads, but it had always been holding out the idea, the principle that purely commercial advertising isn't protected, just had been narrowing the scope of what counts as purely commercial advertising to include, for example, 2 years earlier, it had held that ads advertising abortion services, even though they looked like commercial ads, they were providing information about a service that was provided on the commercial marketplace. Because abortion had to do with a tough political issue, a contentious political issue at the time, that wasn't a purely commercial advertisement. Virginia State Pharmacy Board is the first time the court says, no, even purely ads that are just simply advertising prices for drugs are entitled to First Amendment protection.
So like buy cheap beer, 5 cents.
Or gas is $3.99 a gallon or whatever it may be. The simplest form of price advertising the court holds in Virginia State Board is protected by the First Amendment. And immediately there is criticism, both within the court, First Amendment people outside the court. And really what's amazing about the decision is, you know, some decisions, I think people get worn down into accepting. They slowly forget that they used to hate the decision. Maybe they still would hate the decision if it was handed down today. But it's such a well-established part of the framework that they stop complaining about it. Yeah. Virginia State Board is not one of those decisions. People continue to say it was a bad decision. This marked a terrible departure in First Amendment law. Continues to be a very well-hated decision.
All right. So good. So let's talk about why people hate it first. So, and I'm curious if these are the same or different. Like why people hated it then and why do they hate it now? I'm guessing from my rudimentary knowledge of free speech law, that it's free speech is supposed to be about like important stuff like democracy and, government. And this is like beneath us. This is not important. This is just how much things cost.
Yeah. I mean, there's a way in which the objections are the same. There's a way in which they're different. So they're the same in the way you identify. There's a certain rejection of the idea that we're going to treat commercial speech on the same plane or a similar plane to non-commercial speech.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. It has been traditional that the practice of professions are to be above the morals of the marketplace. This case presents the question whether the practice of pharmacy and the dispensing of drugs should be subject to the morals of the marketplace.
So like saying, right, as you said, beer, sale on beer, doesn't seem like the same kind of august, important democratic speech as, you know, President Trump should be impeached, or is not just a hypothetical example. And so there is a strong view that Virginia State Board represents the beginning of what some have called the imperial First Amendment, where we're just going to be expanding the First Amendment beyond its proper domain. And thereby, because we're extending too much protection to speech that isn't really politically important, or we don't need to protect in order to protect democracy, we're actually going to be intruding on the prerogatives of the democratic legislature, because we're going to allow federal courts to second guess what the decisions legislatures are making. And this is a point that Rehnquist makes in a dissent in Virginia State Board. And then he makes it again in a number of other commercial advertising cases, in which he brings up the specter of Lochner. He says, just like in this, you know, due process cases in the early 20th century, late 19th century, the courts were going outside of their domain and they were striking down legislative enactments when they had no right to do so in the name of democracy. The court's doing the same thing here. And so I think that criticism of Rehnquist continues to be made, that this is just the beginning of the anti-democratic First Amendment.
So how is the criticism of Virginia State Board different today?
One of the ways in which the criticism is a little bit different, maybe, is that the point of Virginia State Board, I don't think people knew what was coming. And so there is a way in which the focus of the criticism about Virginia State at the time is really about advertising per se. I think now it's become sort of emblematic of this broader expansion of the First Amendment. And so
To what?
To include corporate speech. So people just worry that we're extending more and more into this economic domain. And so Virginia State Board now in retrospect looks like the beginning of a slide that hasn't stopped.
Yeah. Okay, great. So I feel like there are two different aspects of this. So tell me if this is right. One is the sort of worry about demeaning the First Amendment. Like we're going to stretch the First Amendment over to stuff that's not as important as its core duty, and then we're going to lose stuff.
Yeah.
And the other is sort of more specifically about anxiety about economic regulation. Even if it was okay to stretch the First Amendment in general, we shouldn't put it in economic regulation, because it's really important that we have lots of state power of economic regulation, because unchecked capitalism is scary. Are they both?
Yes, I think both arguments are made. I feel like the first argument, that it's demeaning, definitely still affecting, underpinning a lot. But there was this early argument made against it, which is that it's going to weaken protections for high-value speech, because we're expanding the First Amendment. Courts are going to be required to apply very similar kinds of principles and doctrinal rules to this low, bad speech, coarse, crass, commercial speech as to high political speech. And so in order to do what they want to do with commercial speech, the worry was we're going to lower the level of protection for all speech.
Yeah.
I feel like that concern has largely gone away, because what we've seen is just that there's increasingly stringent protection for commercial speech, but it hasn't lessened protection for political speech. Although perhaps there are some people who still are worried about that.
Yeah. No, this, and actually, this is something I've often wondered about the First Amendment, and maybe talk about it for just a second. So sometimes I hear this sort of description of the political model of the First Amendment as being, you know, we've got a certain amount of free speech and you're going to use it up, right? If we protect too many different kinds of free speech, then they all only get like 2 free speech points rather than 10 free speech points. But other times you hear a model that's more like, we have to protect really horrible speech because that will strengthen us and our ability to protect really good speech. So we have to let the Nazis march through Skokie because that will let us protect the Black Lives Matter protesters or whoever it is later. So it's more like a virtuous cycle where protecting more speech builds on more speech. So it seems like the commercial speech critique is the first kind, but it seems like we live in a world, maybe it's the opposite. We protected commercial speech, and now we've protected campaign finance and hate speech and, you know, signs and religious speech. So do you have a view of which dynamic it is?
Well, so, and I feel like both those accounts are insufficient really to explain how these dynamics operate, because there is this sort of complex cultural and social world in which legal doctrines operate. And so it is going to be the case sometimes. I do hear the concern that if you are rendering decisions that are really unpopular or they seem illegitimate, it's going to weaken political support and maybe it'll subsequently weaken the sort of commitment of judges. And so I get the like, oh, we mustn't undermine the First Amendment. There's this idea that like the First Amendment has this great popularity, the cultural magnetism, Fred Schauer has said. And so we don't want to do anything to do away with that magnetism. I hear that, but you're right that one of the ways in which you make these kinds of legal ideals of freedom of speech really politically and culturally salient is maybe expanding them. So like we're thinking about free speech all the time. We're constantly being schooled that free speech is an important American virtue because it comes up in all these different domains. And so it does seem like the First Amendment continues to have a kind of cultural magnetism. But at the same time, I also think that there is increasing resistance, certainly on the left, to the way that the First Amendment operates. But on my view, that's not because, and this is where I begin to diverge from the critics, I don't blame that on the expansion of the scope of the domain, because I think that can be actually really useful, as I said, in reminding you of why this matters and making you commit to it. But I think the problem there is that it's so anti-redistributive right now. You know, it has this effect of tending to favor the powerful. I think that is proving politically difficult. But I don't really blame that problem on Virginia State Board.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk about why everybody's wrong now. So why is it fine or good that we have this right to advertise cheap pharmaceuticals or you know, despite what everything you've just said very persuasively about why that doesn't make sense?
Yes, there's two different aspects, I think, to why I like Virginia State Board. Maybe there's a little bit of tension between them, but I really do firmly believe both. Okay, so one is, there's this thing that happens in the New Deal period when we get basically the framework of the modern First Amendment and we get a lot of our modern constitutional law, which is, you know, this is a progressive court. It is really worried about all the things that contemporary critics of Virginia State Board are worried about, which is we don't want having these elite federal courts running roughshod over democratic decision making and important political choices made. But, you know, we live in a democratic society. We don't want the courts to be deciding everything. And so one of the ways in which the court tries to both preserve the importance of judicial review while still allowing the democratic process to operate is by making or suggesting in the Caroline Product opinion, maybe most famously, this distinction between commercial and non-commercial regulation. When we regulate ordinary commercial practices, when we regulate other things, our standard of scrutiny might differ. And I think this is the framework that a lot of the critics of Virginia State Board rely upon and think that it's violating. In Caroline Products, there's this distinction between ordinary commercial regulation, or I think it's regulations affecting ordinary commercial processes,
right,
and other kinds of regulations that affect, you know, either our enumerated constitutional rights or that strike at the heart of our democratic integrity, legitimacy.
So people sometimes say this is like the New Deal settlement is you can regulate the maximum hours and wages of people who work in bakeries, but you can't regulate, you know, whether students can say the Pledge of Allegiance to public school or, you know, access to abortion and things like that.
Yes. And I understand the desire for that to be the distinction that's drawn. The problem is when it comes to the First Amendment, I imagine many other parts of the Constitution, but I'm a First Amendment person, so I'm just going to focus on that right now. When it comes to the First Amendment, it raises immediately all these really difficult questions, because the reality is that a huge amount of speech that travels around our democratic society travels via market mechanisms. It travels in commodified forms, is produced and distributed, disseminated, controlled by profit-oriented actors, aka corporations. And so right from the beginning, and even when it isn't, even when we're talking about sort of small-scale, deeply felt, say, religious expression, that often was, because we live in a market society, that often was being sold for money. So there's these early set of cases that the court has to deal with right around this time of the New Deal settlement involving Jehovah's Witnesses. And they were selling their magazines for money. And so there's this question, well, if they're selling it for money, is this, and we're regulating the ability to do that without a license, is that a commercial regulation or a non-commercial regulation? I think that this distinction proves very difficult for the court to understand, deal with in any kind of sensible way when it comes to the First Amendment. And it is not a useful way of thinking about where we want courts reviewing legislative determinations stringently and where we don't. Because there's a lot of things that look like it's regulation of commercial practice, like, say, campaign finance, that go right to the heart of our political society. And so Virginia State Board, this is the reason people hate it. This is one of the reasons I like it. it suggests or makes very explicit that like this purely commercial thing is just not going to cut it when it comes to the First Amendment. It is not going to limit the scope of the First Amendment's reach.
Yeah. So you mentioned campaign finance. There's a slogan that, you know, many people, Justice Stevens among them, would have in the campaign finance area where he'd say, money is not speech. Congress can regulate money. So as long as they're regulating money, it's okay. It doesn't count as a speech regulation. I take it you're disagree. You think money is speech.
I don't think money is speech. And I'm going to make so many enemies with this podcast, but that's okay. I believe in vigorous debate. Money is not speech, but money facilitates speech. And so when the government regulates money that is being used to pay for speech, we should think that the First Amendment is implicated. Just like if the government regulates newspaper ink. Newspaper ink is not speech. It's ink. Like my six-year-old would think I'm crazy to say ink is speech. It's not speech, but it is a crucial mechanism for a whole important arena of speech. And so if the government is, you know, trying to restrict speech by targeting newspaper ink, I don't want courts to be so dumb as thinking, oh, I can only worry about speech. The First Amendment only talks about speech. So I think money isn't speech, but money can raise all kinds of First Amendment questions. And so, again, there too, I don't think that this commercial, non-commercial distinction is really helping us. Sometimes regulating money doesn't raise serious First Amendment issues. Sometimes it does, as in the campaign finance context. And so simply thinking that the way in which we're going to have a good balance between legislative and judicial power is by making a kind of commercial, non-commercial distinction when it comes to the objects as a regulation, I don't think it works. And Virginia State Board makes clear that that's not going to be good enough from here on out. And I think that's useful because so long as that's the law and the court seems pretty committed to it, we can either complain about it, and that's useful too. It's lots of things. Academics like to complain. But also maybe we have to start thinking about other ways of delimiting the boundaries of the First Amendment, thinking about what's it appropriate for the legislature, what choices is it appropriate for the legislature to be making independent of the courts. And what choices are not.
Okay, good. So maybe let's try to give you a chance to win some of your friends back. For a minute, I'm getting all excited that sounds like my sort of libertarian ideal of government regulation of the First Amendment. But I think that's not where we're going, right? I think even though you're saying that, okay, all these choices by the government to intervene in commercial speech implicate the First Amendment, you haven't yet promised me who's going to win. You haven't yet promised me what kind of regulation is okay. So in Genevieve Lakier's world, what does the First Amendment let the government do? Can they? Yeah.
Okay. This is the second reason I love Virginia State Board. So the first reason is it demolishes this distinction between commercial and non-commercial, I think, as a basis for boundary setting. And I think that's very useful because it raises all kinds of questions then. That's not very concrete. That's just like a negative thing it does. The positive thing it does is it provides us some hint of how we might have a First Amendment that doesn't require a laissez-faire approach to regulation, because of course, that isn't libertarian in the way that precisely maybe you want it to be, because I don't think that the speech market can be left to its, I don't think that the democratic goals of the First Amendment are best facilitated by tying the government's hands in every instance, because the fact is that, you know, in our society, there's tremendous power inequalities that mean that if we're just leaving it to the market, some voices are going to be amplified and some voices are going to have, it's going to be very difficult for them to express themselves. And we might think that this has predictable and overdetermined structural features. You know, the wealthy are going to be able to speak a lot more than the poor. The minorities are going to have real difficulty. And we might think that, you know, for all that it says, the modern First Amendment says it cares about minority or dissident voices, there's going to be a lot of minority and dissident voices that if the government doesn't do anything to correct the imbalances of the market are going to be silenced or muffled, or they're going to have a great deal of difficulty expressing themselves. And so what's interesting about Virginia State Board is it says, step one, purely commercial advertising is protected by the First Amendment. But step two, and this is what I think is so interesting about it, and I would like to expand beyond the commercial speech realm. And this is the third thing I think about Virginia State Board. But so it says commercial advertising is protected, but the government can still prohibit false advertising, misleading advertising. And in contexts where we are worried that the seller is going to confuse the listener, and they're not going to know all the relevant information, the government can mandate disclosure. So, and that has been interpreted to mean we don't get to be paternalistic, which I really like. I like this whole line of cases, really. which is, you know, paternalism is not a good justification for speech regulation. We don't get to tell people, no, 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 it's better for you not to know that thing because then you're going to make bad choices. I'm sure there are people who are going to disagree with me about that, but I do think that the democratic commitments of the First Amendment mean that we should try and not have, we should be against paternalistic regulations. The idea is that the people get to make choices for themselves and they get to tell the government what's correct rather than the reverse. But in situations where, you know, we have to worry about power imbalances between speakers and listeners, or we have to worry about falsity or misinformation, deception, Virginia State Board says, you know, okay, you can regulate in that way. This is in contrast to many other areas of First Amendment regulation where that kind of stuff is not allowed. And so I think one of the downsides of the criticism of Virginia State Board and the sort of like distaste towards it, one of the consequences of that has been to an effort to strictly limit its reach to the commercial speech cases. You know, people haven't stopped complaining, but to the extent that they've gotten used to it, how they've gotten used to it is by strictly segregating this naughty line of cases to deal only with commercial speech and commercial advertising, and so that we can, you know, protect the rest of the First Amendment against maybe its corrosive force. Whereas I want us to take the...
You want this to be the paradigm for...
And think more broadly. Well, that's interesting. Virginia State Board says we're going to recognize that the First Amendment is implicated, but we are really worried about power imbalances and manipulation and fraud and abuse, all the things that we are worried about when we worry about commercial transactions. And so we're going to allow the legislature to regulate speech in these ways. And I think that's really interesting and intriguing.
Okay, so not only I see why this is a great case for you. So not only do you think we should extend the First Amendment to advertising the prices of, you know, random commodities, but then you think all free speech should be like that. We should regulate all free speech the way we allow the government to regulate advertisement of the prices of commodities. You want the commercial speech paradigm to apply everywhere.
Potentially, yes. Now that's a little bit broad. It's going to get me in trouble. I think we should be sensitive to the fact that maybe institutional incentives are different when it comes to different kinds of speech. So Jeff Stone has written really powerfully about the differences between political and non-political speech, advertising and like core political speech when it comes to the government's incentives. Like we might think when government is regulating political speech and when it's regulating essentially its competitors, its opponents, we might worry that there's just much more potential for double dealing or for abuse and manipulation than when it's dealing with commercial speech. Potentially, on the other hand, the companies that are producing the commercial ads are funding the politicians. So it's not obvious to me that that's the case, but that's the kind of questions that I would want us to be thinking about. But in theory, I think the same concerns with power imbalance and with allowing the government to the distinction between paternalistic regulation, which we don't like, and, you know, power correcting regulation, which we do like. I want that to extend to other domains of First Amendment law. Yes.
So let's think about how that would work for a minute. So as I understand the commercial speech paradigm, part of it is sort of what's underlying it is this focus on truth, right? The things the government can do is it can regulate things that are false, that are not true, things that are misleading. So they're not technically false, but they cause you to believe things that are false. Yes. It can require disclosure of things that are true. And again, it can't say like these ideas are bad for you, you shouldn't want them, but what it's mostly trying to do is to correct sort of failures in truth, right? And to kind of like help get more truthful information out there. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay. So how do we translate that to, let's say, politics and morality, where it seems like truth is not the coin of the realm? And maybe it should be, but then is that even possible? Like, is there truth about like what is most just for America?
Yeah. So, well, two things. I think there are two really important implications that expanding Virginia State Board to other domains of First Amendment law might have, and that I would be in favor of both. So one is allowing the government to require disclosures in contexts where we're worried about miscommunication, maybe intentional, maybe unintentional. It's definitely about truth, but really this focus on disclosure is sort of a prioritized way of regulating speech. You know, in recent years, we've seen the court outside of the commercial speech context making it much, much more difficult for the government to require warnings and disclosures.
Yeah.
And that seems to me bad, a retreat from the intuition underlying Virginia State Board, that disclosures, that in cases where there's power imbalance, where you have someone seeking something from someone else and they don't have all the facts, the best, you know, the first step should be at least to make sure that they have access to the relevant information. That seems like a pretty low-hanging fruit, but it turns out it's not low-hanging fruit, because this is sort of one of the pitched areas of fighting in contemporary First Amendment law, and the court has been very anti-disclosure in its approach on the view that, you know, it's not up to the government to be intervening in these kinds of private relationships, and I think that that's wrong and goes against the spirit of what Virginia State Board was saying. Okay, but go to the harder question, which is what do we do about truth? Yeah, I think this is right now, this is the $10 million question, I think, when it comes to the regulation of speech. There are at least provisionally some easy extensions of Virginia State Board one could have. That would still be pretty shocking changes to contemporary law, I think. But I don't think it would...
Like what? Shock me.
So I would be in favor of, I mean, I'm open to pushback and institutional concerns. I don't want to be insensitive to the different contexts in which these rules apply. But, you know, on its face, like if a politician lies about a fact that the audience doesn't have information about, can't check him, and it's difficult to be able to check him, I think we should be open to regulation of that kind of lying, just like we're open to regulation of that kind of lying in the commercial speech context. Because in both cases, the problem is the power imbalance. I mean, whenever possible, we want the market to be able to take care of lies itself. But we know from our regulation of the commercial marketplace, fraud is a huge problem for the operation, the everyday operations of the market. And we have tremendous regulatory concern, you know, a whole framework of laws meant to rout out fraud when it comes to commercials. Sale of goods. This is where I really like taking away the line between the commercial and the non-commercial, because I think it can help illuminate how we could be thinking about these things in the non-commercial sphere. So if fraud is such a problem when it comes to the choices we make about what toothbrush to buy, maybe we should worry about fraud when it comes to the choice about what politicians to represent us. So that'll be one implication, I think, of having a more expansive understanding of Virginia State Board.
And so maybe this is where I'm going to sound like Jeff Stone, but we talk about regulation. I'm just trying to think about how that would work. So like, imagine we have a president who lies about facts that are, you know, within his knowledge, we don't have access to, like what the deliberations were like or what the size of the crowds at some event were or something like that. Well, where would the regulation come from? Congress would pass a law, the president would veto, or now we're imagining prosecutors would prosecute the president and he would pardon himself.
I mean, yeah, the politics of this get really difficult, and maybe it's not good to start with the president. Like, presidents are famously hard to prosecute.
Yeah.
You know, the president is immune from prosecution in all kinds of ways for all kinds of political reasons. But I agree, there are lots of challenges, even, you know, ordinary politicians, not presidents.
Yeah.
Would we worry that there would be, you know, it would be overdetermined by political forces? I don't know. This might be a context in which civil cause of action is better than giving it to the state actors. I mean, perhaps the practical concerns are too severe to overcome, and it's just for practical reasons this is not going to work. And I'm really open to that. But at least at a first cut, as a theoretical matter, when thinking about how should we be conceptualizing the problem of, say, lies and misrepresentations in the political context, I think the approach the Virginia State Board court takes is a good one. And then there's this whole host of other questions about what do we do in the political context.
It's a perfect note to end on.
Thank you, Genevieve, for joining us today. Special thanks to Barbara Flynn Curry and David Curry for the reading of the Constitution in our introduction. Be sure to hit subscribe and follow us on Twitter @UChicagoConLaw.